you're having an enormous impact, a negative downward impact on jobs, on population, on spending.
The economic cost of a smaller state budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, OSHA investigates health and safety complaints at a processing plant in Naknek.
7 days a week, 16 hours straight, they give us a 5 minute break and then you're right back in there putting your green gear on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
State lawmakers who voted to pass the capital budget yesterday say it will help the economy, but it will provide less help than it did just a few years ago when it was twice as large. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
When oil prices fell in 2014, so did the amount of money available for Alaska to repair and expand roads and other infrastructure. The state spent more than $2 billion on the capital budget in 2013. The new budget includes less than a tenth of that. Sarah LaFave handles contracts for Fairbanks Company Exclusive Paving. She notes the state has stopped funding its own construction projects. Now most of the capital budget comes from federal spending.
Once upon a time, the state was able to do state-funded transportation and infrastructure projects, so that would include not just highways, but airports and that type of thing. Those state-funded projects are done.
This decline has contributed to an overall decline in construction jobs across Alaska. According to the State Department of Labor and Workforce Development, there's been a 1/6 drop in construction jobs over the past 3 years. Some trades have been hit particularly hard. Corey Baxter expresses anguish on the effect on the members of his union. He's the Juneau District Representative for the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 302.
It's huge for our members. I'd say over 90% of our work has to deal with the capital budget. And with the huge cut we've had over the last couple of years, it's hurt us big time. A lot of our members, you know, are thinking about moving out of state.
The capital spending decline has hit regions in different ways. Southeast Alaska was already affected by the overall decline in state spending. Green Coast Data Director Melani Shivens says the region lost roughly 50 construction jobs last year and could lose a projected 100 this year.
You're having an enormous impact, a negative downward impact on jobs, on population, on spending, and so it's been really frustrating and disappointing to watch.
Without a sudden surge in oil prices, the state won't be able to fund projects like it used to. But there are steps that the legislature can take to increase capital spending, according to some construction industry advocates. Associated General Contractors of Alaska Executive Director John McKinnon says state support for three often maligned mega projects would help. They are the Juneau Access Road, the Kinnick Arm Bridge, and the Susitna-Watonna Dam. Governor Bill Walker has decided against pursuing the projects. McKinnon says $150 million in state spending for those projects would draw much more federal spending that would put contractors to work.
You look at some of the greatest projects that have been done in this country, the Hoover Dam, the Golden Gate Bridge, the Coastal Highway that went down through the Florida Keys. Those projects were done in and around the depth of depression.
McKinnon's wife, Anna McKinnon, is a Republican senator who oversees the capital budget as co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee. John McKinnon says the capital budget decline has affected private spending.
Part of that has to do with the optimism out there of investors, private investors and private money. You don't see a lot of private money being spent out there.
But the oil price decline has also had a large effect on private construction. The Institute of Social and Economic Research projects overall construction spending will be down $700 million this year. Most of the decline is from the private sector. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
$5 million is included in the capital budget for the state's university system to spend on major building renovations and repairs. The legislature passed its capital budget yesterday, and it's waiting for the governor's signature. University of Alaska officials say the Board of Regents will decide how to distribute the money to Alaska universities at their August 9th meeting. Michael Seary, vice chancellor for the administration at the University of Alaska Southeast, says capital project dollars typically go to major building projects. For example, he says an operating budget would pay for fixing a damaged roof, but a roof replacement is paid for through the university's capital budget. He says UAS generally spends money on capital projects to save money on upkeep over time. The body of the pilot was recovered last night after a plane crashed yesterday in Lake Clark National Park. Joel Black of Pemberville, Ohio, was flying a Cessna 206 Thursday morning when the plane crashed. Megan Richot is a spokesperson for Lake Clark National Park. She explained the recovery.
Last night, the Alaska State Troopers and National Park Rangers were able to take a State Trooper helicopter to the site of the crash and recover the pilot's body.
Black was the only occupant of the plane, according to Regal Aviation. The National Transportation Safety Board will investigate the incident to try and find the cause of the crash. The flight path has also not been determined. A state OSHA investigator is looking into claims of workplace health and safety issues at the Silver Bay Seafoods processing plant in Naknek. The state has not said specifically what problems have been alleged or who made the claims. Silver Bay Seafoods has not responded to KDLG's requests for comment. The company is on the receiving end of some particularly bad press in Puerto Rico, where a number of its seasonal workers came from this summer. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Processing Bristol Bay's annual salmon harvest takes the blistering effort of thousands of employees working at about a dozen major companies. Deborah Kelly, the Labor Standards and Safety Director for Alaska's Department of Labor and Workforce Development, says seafood processing is what her division considers an emphasis industry.
Because of the hazardous nature of the work, the short seasons, long working hours, and transient workforce, we do try to emphasize our enforcement inspections and also our consultation services to assist employers to keep their workers safe and healthy.
Many of Bristol Bay's processing companies had workforce problems at their plants this summer. The run came in much larger than expected, and as the fleet hauled in huge catches day after day, the demands on the processors to keep up were high and the labor force was stretched thin. Still, only one company has so far caught the state's attention.
We sent an investigator out to inspect the complaint items, inspect the workforce, and look for hazards to employees there at Silver Bay Seafoods in Naknek.
Alaska Governor Bill Walker was personally made aware that employees from Puerto Rico had gone home from Silver Bay Seafoods with some serious complaints and allegations. The governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rosello Navarez, delivered a letter with his concerns to Walker at a governor's conference in Rhode Island earlier this month. Puerto Rico's largest newspaper, El Nuevo Dia, published an exclusive accounting of three Puerto Rican employees who returned from Naknek, saying they had been mentally terrorized and physically abused. Their allegations tend towards the outrageous, suggesting the company housed employees in ghettos based on ethnicity and had armed guards monitoring their movements. The three unnamed former workers interviewed by the newspaper also say that the long hours, poor food, and cramped quarters were not what they were expecting. Roy White from Naknek worked at Silver Bay for several weeks this season and also left on bad terms.
The working conditions are horrible. I mean, they're 16 hours straight, 7 days a week, 16 hours straight. They give us this 5 minutes, a 5 minute break, and then you're right back in there putting your green gear on.
White also said the food served to employees was worse than he'd seen at other processing plants he'd worked at. While he did not corroborate the wilder claims made by the three Puerto Rican employees, White did say that the workload and conditions were not what he'd been led to believe when he signed on.
No, because their description on the computer was way different than what they told us, than what was actually how it is.
White and his girlfriend say they both sought treatment for minor work-related injuries, then quit working at Silver Bay Seafoods. He says he will not be reapplying anytime soon.
People are the lowest thing on that list in that whole business. We are expendable.
According to El Nuevo Dia, the matter has been brought to the attention of government authorities in both the U.S. and Puerto Rico. It's unclear what other investigations may be underway, but Director Kelly says the state's OSHA investigation could take a few weeks to 6 months to wrap up.
Once the investigation is complete, we will inform the complainant, of course, of what we have found. And at the time when everything is final, the case and all the information within becomes public record.
If the state finds that Silver Bay Seafoods violated safety and health standards in the workplace, they could face fines of tens of thousands of dollars per violation. Kelly said she could not comment yet as to the merit of the complaints being investigated, and Silver Bay Seafoods CEO Rich Riggs refused several requests for comment this week. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation will pay more than $50,000 in penalties after reaching an agreement with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. According to a release from the EPA, during a 2016 inspection, it found that NSEDC's Norton Sound Seafood Products plant in Nome violated the company's seafood process discharge permit. The EPA says violations included exceeding the dimension requirements for seafood processing waste residues, failing to complete required record keeping, and not adequately monitoring the processing plant's waste conveyance system. Tyler Rhodes, chief operating officer for NSEDC, responded in an emailed statement saying NSEDC has, quote, fully cooperated with the EPA in this matter, which has primarily dealt with record keeping protocols. Ground waste from seafood processors can include entrails, bones, fins, and other trimmings. The EPA says strong tides and water currents don't always disperse the waste coming from the Norton Sound facility, and if this is not managed properly, it can at worst create dead zones on the seafloor. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Russian explorers return to Dillingham.
Yeah, I'm reading quite a lot archives and books of professional historical people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A state review concludes that Fairbanks police officers were justified in fatally shooting a local man in Fairbanks in May. Results of the Office of Special Prosecutions investigation released on Thursday say the four officers who killed Sean Buck on a Mitchell Expressway on-ramp believed they or other officers were about to be killed or injured. Buck, on May 25th, was fired on by four officers as he attempted to escape arrest and crashed a truck into an Alaska State Trooper patrol vehicle. Police say Buck, who had outstanding felony warrants, was holding a handgun as he backed into the trooper vehicle and that he had previously fired at officers multiple times during a high-speed chase that began on the old Richardson Highway, where officers initially tried to stop him. While Unalaskans may be resigned, prey for eagle attacks, advances in technology have introduced a less prepared victim, drones. KUCB's Barrett Wilbur has more on the most recent casualty.
Before sending a $6,000 drone to record aerial footage in Unalaska, Emmett Fitch warned the pilot he might want to reconsider one thing.
It's black with a white body. I said, that looks a lot like an eagle. We should maybe paint it a different color.
Fitch, who runs local Wi-Fi provider Optimera, was helping an advertising agency shoot promotional footage. The Robertson and Partners team flew up from Las Vegas to film on a bluebird day. But things did not go as planned.
All of a sudden, they just lost comms with the drone. What's going on, you know? And so he's frantically hitting the button that says, you know, return home, return home.
The team was worried. The pilot wanted to prove he wasn't at fault so the drone's insurance coverage would kick in. But none of them were exactly sure what happened.
So he was able to go back and look at the footage in slow motion right towards the end. And it just, you can see it, the yellow part of the eagle talon. And then it's gone.
Fitch says they couldn't believe it. Their footage was gone, and their plans were ruined.
After it happened, it was kind of like we all lost a member of the team.
While eagle-drone interactions are unusual, they're not unheard of. Police in France and the Netherlands have trained the Raptors to snatch drones from the sky. And Alaska gets that service for free. And this time, it's paying local dues. With their machine out of commission, a local drone pilot says the company turned to him for footage instead. As for the future of drones in Unalaska, Emmett Fitch feels there is a clear solution.
They should be made, you know, to look different than birds of prey.
In Unalaska, I'm Barrett Wilbur.
For the second year in a row, people around Dillingham, Alegnegik, and Woodtickchick State Park and the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge are reporting a massive outbreak of caterpillars. KDLG's Avery Lill has the story.
Visitors to Woodtickchick State Park were greeted by an unusual sight this summer. Alders that are normally dense, green, and leafy were bare.
It looks almost like fall came early, so everything's kind of brown and without any leaves on it.
That's Daniel Schindler, a professor of aquatic and fishery sciences from the University of Washington. He does research in the park. There are reports of defoliation on the east side of the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge and up the entire chain of the five lakes in Woodtickchick State Park. Up to the second lake, Schindler says the alders were completely defoliated up to 1,000 feet in elevation. It's the most damage to vegetation from caterpillars that he's seen in about 20 years working in the region.
We're seeing at least two species. One is a brighter green one that's a little bigger caterpillar. Most of them are brown with dark stripes on them. So there's at least two, maybe three, possibly four species that we're looking at here.
These caterpillars likely belong to the family Noctuidae. Right now, they're dropping off plants to burrow into the soil where they'll winter over in their pupa form. In the spring, they'll emerge as moths. But before they hunkered down for the winter, birds, fish, and bears had a heyday.
Usually, just before the salmon show up, the rainbows are pretty skinny. And this year, they have big, extended bellies on them, and when we sample what they're eating, it's mostly caterpillars. Even the bears are eating them. The bear scat is full of caterpillar remains.
Now that the very hungry caterpillars are disappearing, the alders are quickly regrowing their leaves. That's something Schindler says they did last year as well.
And then by middle of September, when most of the vegetation was starting to go yellow and brown, the stuff that resprouted was still going gangbusters and was bright green. Pretty clear the plants have some sort of evolutionary history with them. My wonder is whether the plants can handle 2-3 years of this in a row, and that's where there may be some long-term damage to the vegetation.
The caterpillars might be nearly gone for the season, but the question remains, why the sudden spike?
Some of it seems to be related to climate conditions, so warm winters increase the survival of those forms that are in the soil. So it's probably some interaction between their populations and the winter climate.
Whatever the cause, it's unlikely that this will be a regular occurrence in the years going forward.
They're really boom or bust type dynamics, and at least in Scandinavia, where people have studied them a long time, it's often, you know, a decade between major outbreaks, and then they'll explode for a year or two and then disappear for a long time.
It's hard to predict when the population will hit its peak and bust, but it does seem likely that the area will see another spring full of these noctuid moths. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Education scholarships and grants for NSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, are available. To learn where the possibilities this education can take you, visit beanengineeralaska.com. This community message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil. Energy lives here.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmiut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Zachariah Hughes. This week on AK, from Russia with maps. This summer, an expedition of Russian adventurers arrived in Dillingham to retrace an historic route taken by Russian explorers in 1830, when Alaska was still under the control of the Russian Empire. KDLG's Allison Mollenkamp caught up with these modern-day adventurers before they hit the river.
The visitors are greeted in Dillingham by an enthusiastic local crowd. 30 residents are packed into the senior center to meet the expedition of 12 Russians and one American. Everyone is sharing in a potluck dinner of salmon dip, mousse with vegetables, all local of course. For dessert, two cakes, one emblazoned with the Russian and American flags, and a second that reads, "Welcome to our Russian friends." Standing between the crowd and their dinner, though, are several welcome speeches. Dillingham Mayor Alice Ruby highlights the historical significance of the visit.
We're especially honored that in this year, when we commemorate the sale of Alaska from Russia to the U.S., that you've chosen Bristol Bay for your 2017 expedition.
The journey is led by Dr. Mikhail Molokov, a trained physician who also happens to be an explorer.
Hello from Russia.
He made a name for himself in Russia by venturing to the North Pole. This is his 10th trip to Alaska, a fascination sparked by his connection to another Russian explorer named Lavrentiy Zagoskin, who died in Molokov's hometown. On his trips through Alaska, he's chasing a shadow of his forefathers' experiences first exploring the region.
I have the same feelings, and I know it's exactly like Vasiliev had 200 years ago, like Zagoskin had 170 years ago. That's why I can read history, not through official papers, not through official reports, archives. Just through nature, and for me it's like a machine to go back to history.
That first name you mentioned, Vasiliev, that's a reference to Ivan Iakolovic Vasiliev, another imperial explorer and one who navigated an impressive journey through southwest Alaska. Molokov's team is retracing a route Vasiliev took in 1830 up the Wood River through the Tikchik Lakes to the Kuskokwim River. At that time, Russians had overhunted most of the beaver in the Nushagak and were looking for new stocks. Molokov places a high value on historical accuracy.
Yeah, I'm reading quite a lot of archives and books of professional historical people. And actually, it usually takes many months to prepare any type of expedition.
In addition to enjoying nature and reliving history, Molokov hopes his trips will foster relationships with people living in the region.
Doesn't matter what's going there on the political level, yeah, but between people, our relations is getting much more open, and we are glad to be here again.
As part of that goal, the Russian expedition helped erect a monument to John W. Clark and to Fyodor Kolmogorov. Clark was one of the people who helped found the Bristol Bay commercial salmon fishery. He also established the Alaska Commercial Company, which was the successor to the trading post run by Fyodor Kolmogorov at Nushagak. Placing the monument was also a bit of a break from traveling for the Russians. After the diplomacy of the potluck, the group is about to launch from Snag Point. The occasion is a mix of each adventurer's personal preparations. Some chat with friends they've made during their brief time in Dillingham, others play music or dance. The last step is to pack all the provisions into six kayaks. Dr. Molokov's younger son, Alexei Molokov, tells the potluck crowd that on top of catching fish, the group is packing plenty of its own supplies.
We have canned meat, canned chicken, and rice, noodles, yes, and different delicious stuff like Nutella.
The youngest member of the group is just 14 years old. While his older compatriots take their time getting their things in order, Ivan Korobov is already set, standing by his kayak in the water, excited for the trip.
It's quite cold. Like, I think it will be very difficult, and I hope we will not have a lot of problems. But I think it will be very cool and very fascinating, you know.
Despite the difficulty of a three-week kayaking expedition, Korobov has time to appreciate the natural beauty of the area.
Here is very peaceful and a lot of good places, very good fish that here is everywhere.
He and the rest of the team will have plenty of time to take in the scenery. Their kayak trip is scheduled to take 3 weeks, but their last expedition to Bristol Bay was 2 weeks late. Molokov says that won't happen again. This time around, their plane tickets back are non-refundable. For KDLG, I'm Allison Mollenkamp.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Casey Ketchum in Anchorage. Ketchum is the head cook at City Diner, and this weekend, he'll defend his first place title at Anchorage's Beer and Bacon Festival.
There is a kind of a quintessential Alaskan personality. It,
I think it's part of just we have so much space up here. We're allowed to kind of develop our personalities bigger than they get in a lot of other states. Especially when you're born up here, you're used to the freedom of having the room to run, scream, and grow. But when you're a kid, it's great. A lot of outdoors, fun things to do, camping and fishing and hunting, all that good stuff. And as a teenager, it's a little more stifling, not having the ability to hop in your car and drive to a different state. I think that's why a lot of teenagers up here kind of start getting out of the state as soon as they're able. And that's what I did, and then traveled around a little bit, but come back, because it's home. You know, you get used to it. I've been at City Diner about almost 7 years. Got a job, though. You know, started applying to a bunch of restaurants because I wanted experience, and they got me a job working on the fryer, and kept doing apparently good enough for them to keep giving me job opportunities, and here I am now, general manager of it, head chef. Chef Al Levinson, who's one of the partners in ownership of the diner, contacted me and said, "Casey, we're doing this beer and bacon festival." We did it, and we were lucky enough, or good enough, depending how you look at it, to win. It's a BLT soup is what we call it. Bunch of ingredients, obviously bacon and tomatoes and stuff like that, but what really tips it off is, and I don't know if I'm gonna get in trouble for telling you, but red peppers, and then at the end when it's boiling hot, you throw in chopped lettuce. And just kind of let that, and the lettuce will actually, the flavor of the lettuce will actually absorb into the soup. And so it actually tastes like a BLT sandwich. Up in the Ante is tough. It's such a killer soup. It's really hard to go one step above it. I'm trying to do something savory. I call them a PBBJ. I'm doing a pimento butter and bacon jam little crostinis. It'll be kind of interesting. And I've been playing around with it for 2 months, so.
Casey Ketchum lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Allison Mollenkamp and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Quentin Chandler in Juneau, Dave Benninger, Allison Mollenkamp, and Avery Lill in Dillingham, Barrett Wilbur and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Davis Hovey in Nome, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided for all the training programs, providing students with housing, food, books, and tools. Learn more by calling 1-800-733-JOBS. This message sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc. A Veterans Town Hall featuring Dr. Timothy Ballard will take place on August 1st from 5 to 6:30 p.m. in the Mendenhall Valley Public Library in Juneau. The VA welcomes frank and open discussions of veterans' concerns in all program areas. Time will be made available for individuals to address their concerns in one-on-one sessions. For more information, email samuel.hudson@va.gov. This message sponsored by the VA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.